episode 433 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. Time for another Valiant Sunday episode. I hope you all enjoyed last week's Valiant Sunday. It was the live panel from San Diego Comic-Con. Apologize if the sound wasn't always as good as it could have been. Some people on the panel tend to talk louder than others. So hopefully next year I'll have a little bit more lead time and I'll be able to get a little bit of a better recording. Plus, the other thing is that I was running around from place to place. I honestly didn't even know if I would be able to stay for the whole Valiant panel, but it worked out. And so I hope that you all got a chance to listen to that and hear what they had to say. I thought before I get into the couple of issues that I'm going to talk about this episode, that I'd kind of give my thoughts on sort of the current state of Valiant. If you did listen to the episode, the panel from San Diego, we didn't get a whole lot of information. You know, the kind of the one and only announcement we've had with this new regime, so to speak, is the Valiant Beyond, those four titles, Faith in the Dream Side, The Live Wire, which is now an ongoing rather than a limited, which is a welcome change. The Bloodshot Rising Spirit, which is kind of a prequel to the relaunch of Bloodshot in 2012. And then The Incursion, which that seemed to be kind of the title that had the most curiosity, people wondering the most about it. We know the least about that of anything other than it's going to be a little bit of a mini event, their first Valiant's first event of 2019. But Mel Kylo, the marketing director, is keeping it under wraps, keeping it hush hush. I don't know if he's hoping that that's going to kind of build momentum and curiosity about what the title is going to be, or if they just don't have everything locked down, or if they're just saving it to kind of drum up some interest at New York Comic Con. Again, I just don't know. I didn't talk to Mel about it. I didn't ask him about it. You know, I know these guys personally. They're friends. I don't want them to feel like I'm trying to take advantage of my friendship to try to get, you know, insider info. You know, if they volunteer information off the record, you know, it's off the record. That's what it is. But I don't go fishing for it. It's just not the kind of person that I am. If they want me to know, they'll let me know. And there are times I do ask questions and they're like, I can't really say. I'm totally fine with that. I'm not one to kind of, you know, poke and prod and, oh, come on, I won't say anything kind of thing. I just, you know, I'm still a comic book fan at heart and I want to be surprised and I want to be able to enjoy the stories spontaneously, just like all of you fans do. And I've found over the years that I like to be surprised more than I used to be, in as much as movie trailers and TV shows and stuff like that. Like, I used to watch every movie trailer, go see just about every movie. And now I've kind of come more around to the point where, and I don't know if it's just kind of the social media nature of fandom these days, where things are spoiled and you don't get a surprise. And maybe it's a difference in the way they even make movie trailers now. It's so hard to keep things under wraps, you know. You can kind of look at the Marvel movies as an example of that, where they're giving out fake scripts to some of the actors with scenes that don't even appear in the movies because they don't want things spoiled. They don't want things leaked. I mean, there's something to be said for the experience of discovering this stuff through reading it, right? Look to the comic industry. A real good recent example is the Die, Die, Die title from Robert Kirkman, which just came out, I think, the Wednesday before Comic-Con, or maybe right around the 1st of July, maybe the 11th, I think, is when it came out. Now, retailers even had no idea that this title was coming out. And Kirkman's stated purpose for doing this was he wanted to bring back that feeling when he used to walk into the comic shop or walk over to the newsstand and look to see what was there, right? You'd be totally surprised by what was there. You had no idea. Whereas now in the social media age, it's very hard to get that kind of surprise. So what he did was he created this new title with art by Chris Burnham called Die, Die, Die. And he shipped the number of books to retailers that would equal the number of issues of his Oblivion Song title that came out earlier this year. He matched that order. if the retailers didn't want it, it was fully returnable. But if they did, it was there. It was, you know, they found out the day they got their comics, Tuesday, I guess the 10th of July. But again, I think it just goes to show the lengths you have to go to be surprised in comics these days. So I don't mind Mel kind of keeping things close to the vest, and they'll announce it when it's time. That being said, I do wish that the panelists had been able to give us a little more information. I think kind of the only new bits of information we got were the fact that Livewire was going to be an ongoing. And then they also announced that there's going to be a tempered glass cover coming for a few of the titles, which is really, really cool in a way, you know, kind of in line with those metal covers, those brushed metal covers that they've done. But at the same time, there's a little part of me that just, you know, it just screams, ah, here we go, another gimmick, right? Valiant has all, you know, they're a smaller publisher. They've always done these kind of things, and they're kind of cool, you know, like recycling a bunch of the metal foil from Wildcats 2 that was printed in excess way back in the 90s, and using that same foil for the covers of Quantum and Woody. Again, it's a cool idea. It gets interest. But at the end of the day, we really just need more people caring about the characters and the stories. So I don't really know what the answer is. I feel like they're still finding their footing in a way. You know, again, some of the players and some of the people on the panel have been with Valiant for a while, but not necessarily in these same types of roles. And there are a lot of new people as well. So, I mean, when you look at how long it took Dinesh and company to kind of get rolling, and granted this new regime, I think is the word I used earlier, this new Valiant team, they're not starting from zero the way Dinesh and the rest of his team were. So they're a little bit ahead of the game in that sense, but still, it hasn't even been a year, right? So do I worry about the future of Valiant? You know, of course I do, much more so than when Dinesh and his team were in place. You know, we've seen the DMG stock over in the Chinese stock market have precipitously fallen over the past month or so. You know, you hear the term too big to fail, and it may be that DMG is, but it also could be that it's not. And then we're looking at an acclaim situation all over again. But I got to think that somebody would step in and buy the Valiant properties from DMG before it got to that point. But then we end up with a situation where if it's, you know, like Marvel or DC or some big corporation like that, all of a sudden we've gone from this, you know, beloved publisher that where we feel like we're, you know, a family and there's, you know, transparency and communication to, you know, more of a corporate situation where there's a big kind of wall between us fans and the company. So I hope it doesn't get to that point. I hope that the team over there manages to keep things afloat. Again, if they do fail, it's not because they don't care or for lack of passion or trying, because everybody over there from the editor-in-chief Joe Illidge to, you know, Robert Myers to you know, the creators like Joshua Dysart and Matt Kent, they all very, very much care about these characters. They're passionate about the world and the stories that they're creating. So as I said, if it does fail, it won't be because of their lack of trying. So anyway, onto the books that I'm going to be talking about this episode. There are a couple of books that I've been wanting to talk about for a while, and it just seemed like there was never a good time. I didn't want to spoil them because I think these books came out on the 11th also. So I didn't want to talk about them too soon after they came out because I wanted you guys all to have a chance to read them. I didn't want to talk about them when I got my preview copies because then I would have been talking about it the Sunday before you got a chance to read them. And then, of course, last week was the Valiant panel from San Diego. So that being said, I'm going to be talking about Ninja K number 9, which wraps up kind of this, I guess, the team storyline that's been going on with Ninjak and his allies fighting against. I don't know that we have a name, or if we did have a name for this supervillain group, you know, these immortals that have kind of teamed together. But this wraps up the storyline of them. Just scanning. Coalition, yeah, that's what they're calling themselves. So I had voiced my reservations when I first saw that the second arc of Ninja K was going to be, you know, Ninjak, Livewire, Ginger to some extent, Punk Mambo, and Dr. Mirage, because I had said I really prefer Ninjak as a solo character. I don't feel he necessarily works that well in team, in a team setting, even though he was part of Unity. And especially because the first arc of Ninja K was so amazing by Christos Gage. So now that this second arc has kind of come to a conclusion, I am going to say that I was pleasantly surprised by just how much I enjoyed it. So let me give the creative team real quickly. I mentioned writer Christos Gage. The art is by Juan Jose Reap. Colors by Jordi Belair. We've got letters by A Larger World Studios. So as I mentioned, this wraps up the kind of the team storyline that's been going on here. And what I love about it is how much Gage really leans into what I was just talking about how Ninjak doesn't necessarily play well with others in a team. So just to give a quick recap, MI6 discovered that there was this gathering of immortals that are tend to be more on the evil side of things, I guess you'd say, calling themselves the Coalition, and sent Ninjak in. He knew that he was going to need help. He wasn't going to be able to handle this on his own. So then he recruited Ginger, Livewire, Punk Mambo, and Dr. Mirage to go in and help fight against these people. And what we discovered in issue 9 was that there's another part of that team that we didn't see, part of the Coalition that we didn't see early on, called the Dying One. And basically, when she dies, she's able to re-inhabit somebody else who possibly just died or was just born, things like that. But it causes her problems, right? Like she either wakes up in a body of an infant, or she dies and wakes up in the body of somebody else who just died, like, you know, some homeless person, penniless, living on the streets, and she's got to, you know, take the time to build back up. So this whole reason for these immortals being where they are in Mexico City and kind of setting up the heroes in a way is all to eventually get the Dying One, Gilad's body. So if you've read Wrath of the Eternal Warrior, we know Gilad's has chosen not to return to life, so to speak. But his body's being inhabited by another creature from the dead side. And once that creature is able to bring over its true form, it will transfer its consciousness or soul or whatever you want to call it to its true body. And then the Dying One will get Gilad's body. So that's kind of what's going on. That's what the heroes discover in this issue 9. But it doesn't quite work out that way. They're able to foil the entity from this high caste entity is how Dr. Mirage puts it. They're able to keep him from crossing over with his true body. Basically, Ninjak inflicts such excruciating pain upon the Eternal Warrior, even though he's his friend, he's like, he's had centuries to get used to pain, whereas you're probably feeling it for the first time. And the entity's like, you know what? Piss on this world. I'm leaving. And so we think in a way that perhaps the heroes have won, right? But what happens is, and spoilers if you haven't read it, the Dying One kills herself just at that moment, which allows her to then take over the Eternal Warrior's body, and then she flees. So not exactly a clean victory for Ninja K or Ninjak and his team. So the rest of them managed to escape with the exception of Ultimo, but Jonin, Lincoln March, and Kosti managed to flee to the dead side and from there go somewhere else. So again, not a clean victory. I'm sure we haven't seen the last of them. But the best part about the issue for me is the last couple of pages, because just as I was talking about how I just don't feel like Ninjak works well as a team. His teammates call him out on that. You know, Dr. Maj is like, hey, sorry that, you know, we weren't able to do more. You weren't able to technically save Gilad. The Dying One has control of his body. If you find him or her, or whatever, you find the Dying One, let me know. But it may be the last time that I help you unless you change the way you do things. You know, keeping battle plans from partners, hoarding knowledge, only letting us know what you think we need to know at the last second. You know, going into battle without all the facts is exactly how, you know, I lost my husband. I won't be a part of that. And Punk Mambo says the same thing. Next time you need me, if it's as anything other than an equal partner, sawed off. And Livewire takes it one step further, right? She's like, you've spoken so passionately against what MI6 did and the ninja program, manipulating people and removing people, any distractions or anything that could keep you from having a normal life. And then you turn around and do the same thing to your supposed teammates, right? Deception, manipulation, subverting people in service of the goal of the mission for the mission to succeed. It's like an abused child growing up to be an abuser. It's not something that I want to be a part of. And Livewire is like, I know fundamentally you're a good man. And yeah, I hate to see you make these kind of choices. You have to fight to stay a good man. If you don't fight harder, you're going to become something that I don't want you to become. And what's really kind of impactful about this, obviously this entire storyline takes place before Harbinger Wars 2, right? Amanda McKee, she could be really take a bit of her own advice, right? Based on the choices that she makes in Harbinger Wars 2 to basically black out the world. She's really crossed the line. So apparently she forgot this lesson she was trying to teach Colin. And obviously if you've read Harbinger Wars 2, you understand that she's kind of pushed to the ultimate edge and had to make a split second decision. But we've talked at length about it on the show about whether she's, you know, was right in doing that, whether she was wrong, just how many people she may have killed. You know, she may be the greatest mass murderer in the history of humankind based on, you know, nobody having power. You can't land airplanes, you know, people in surgery, people in hospitals, people in childbirth. Like, you know, we talked about it, as I said. So, but interesting to have those words come from her. And again, I think it's awesome that I talked about how Ninjak really does not play with others. He's really at his core a lone wolf, right? And they've put him on teams before. You know, he was in Unity for a while, seemed to work out okay. But when the storyline started, I talked about how I just don't like him in a team setting. I don't think that's the kind of character he is. And I love the fact that Christos Gage totally leaned into that, right? Like, that was part of the whole point of the story in a way, is where he leaves Ninjak at the end of this story feeling like, wow, I really kind of screwed up. I really do maybe need to take a look at myself or maybe not team up with people. Unfortunately, I think the array of bad guys, the coalition was really too much for him to handle on his own. But again, it's not normally the kind of mission he undertakes, right? I mean, he's more go in on the sly and, you know, plant some bombs to blow things up or rescue somebody or assassinate somebody. I mean, that's more his speed. So asking him to do this was really, again, not the best choice. That being said, I did enjoy everybody. I mean, I enjoyed the story and I enjoyed the team aspect of it as much as I didn't think Ninjak necessarily fit in, but I'd love to see a team with the rest, right? Like maybe take Ninjak out and put in Eternal Warrior or put in Exo Manowar. Because I did enjoy the dynamic, especially between Dr. Mirage and Punk Mambo, even though Punk Mambo is not one of my favorite characters, kind of indifferent about her. But I did enjoy, because they both have kind of a supernatural bent to their characters, they have a lot in common in a way, and so I enjoyed that interaction. And then Livewire's, you know, Livewire, she's always awesome. So, and also, there's not a lot of great villains in the Valiant universe. It's one of those things that I feel like is a lot harder to establish in a comic book universe, because, you know, usually you don't have monthly books for the villains as characters, right? So you're, and you can't overuse the villains because then it stops making sense. Like, right, if they're defeated, how do they come back month after month after month, right? Got to give them a little time to, you know, go to jail or escape, to lick their wounds, whatever. So because you don't have them showing up in a book month after month after month, it takes a lot longer to establish their, you know, personality and their motivations and make them interesting, which is part of the reason, again, I just I'm kind of in awe of what Joshua Dysart was able to do with Toyo Harada. And again, to mention last week's episode, if you listen to the chat that we had at the San Diego Comic-Con Valiant Fans panel, when I asked all the panelists, you know, Harada, hero or villain, and everybody had different answers and different reasons for giving that answers, it just goes to show what an incredible job Joshua Dysart did in creating this new version of Toyo Harada, that people could see him so differently. He's such a interesting character and complex and everything. So in order to get to that point with some other villains, because I feel like that's one area where the Valiant universe is lacking, complex and compelling villains, it takes time. And so getting to see the villains in this arc, the Coalition, Jonin and the rest, getting to see them interact with each other, and kind of evolve and, you know, us start to understand their motivations was another positive of the story as well. Especially Jonin, you know, being that he was with the ninja program for so long and on the side of angels for so long, very curious to know why he went over to the other side. So all in all, a really successful arc. I did enjoy it, but I'm looking forward to the next issue, issue 10, which focuses on Ninja H and getting back to more of a solo focus in the Ninjak title. All right, now on to Shadow Man number 5. We give the creative team really quickly. It's written by Andy Diggle. Art is by Doug Braithwaite. Colors by Jose Villarubia. And letters by Simon Boland. So Shadow Man's been one of those characters the Valiant struggled to get right since the relaunch. And now we're, 6 years in? So I feel like with what Andy Diggle has planned and what we've seen so far, they may finally be on the right track. So when this new series for Shadow Man started, the first three issues were kind of setting up the status quo, current status quo of Shadow Man. You know, we saw Matt Kent had him in the dead side as the Magpie. We saw him show up various times. He was basically a servant of Baron Samedi. And in order to free himself from the Baron, he enlisted the aid of his longtime ally, Alyssa Miles. Didn't quite work out the way that he wanted. And at the end of issue 3, we saw Jack's spirit was like left his body, was cast out into the void. Didn't know what was going to happen from there. But what Andy Diggle did is maybe find a way for Jack to learn, right? How to control the Loa, how to be a better Shadow Man, because we know it's really a legacy character. And in the past, some of Jack's ancestors, including his father, have done a much better job of controlling it and not letting their anger or their emotion kind of cloud their ability to be the Shadow Man. Something else that Diggle has done that's worked really well is that he's able to bring in a lot of the things that we've seen in the Shadow Man story, this version of Shadow Man so far, like the abettors, right? Everything counts still. It's not like, okay, for what they did before didn't work, let's throw it out and see if we can't kind of reboot and fix it. So I do like that. I always like when writers do that. They find a way to make all the previous iterations work. And for me personally, I didn't mind the first Justin Jordan Shadow Man book. I'm not sure why it got so much dislike. There were some things about it that I didn't care for necessarily. You know, I did like the 90s version of Shadow Man more, but that's not to say that they couldn't have gotten there. But I do feel like when, I think it was Peter Milligan, that run came in and it started to be more about Jack being angry all the time and being this abuser. That didn't fly with me necessarily. And I don't want to say it was like I told you so moment, but I found myself thinking, okay, I thought that what Justin Jordan was doing was pretty good. And people were complaining about it. It's like, be careful what you wish for, right? Now, I guess the sales weren't that good on it. And so they rebooted, they brought in Peter Milligan, and that, then it was even worse. And it's like, well, you guys wanted something different. And this is what we got. So I'm glad that we finally have somebody like Andy Diggle, who's a very great, who's a really good writer and has great ideas, very good idea man, to come on the book, come on the character. And he's got it planned out for years, right? And that has me really, really excited. And I haven't heard a lot of response, but those people that I have talked to about Shadow Man have seemed to enjoy it. So as I said, issue 3 ended that first arc, and it was Jack's spirit leaving his body. And then with issue 4, we see that his spirit inhabited one of his ancestors, Maxim Boniface, the Shadow Man of the 1940s. And again, it's Jack getting a chance to witness firsthand, and even to kind of experience to some extent, because he is inhabiting the body of his ancestors, to see other previous Shadow Man who were able to control the Loa, rather than have the Loa control them, which is kind of where Jack's been all along. So with what happened with issue 4, I started thinking, okay, maybe we're going to see Jack travel through time, through jump around from previous Shadow Man to previous Shadow Man, bearing witness to his ancestors who've been successful as Shadow Man, and able to kind of work more in tandem with the Loa rather than being a slave to it or trying to overpower it through anger or emotion. So issue 5, that is indeed the case. We see that it starts out in the 1880s. It's in the Old West, and we see Marius Boniface, who we've seen before. Again, this goes back to Diggle making sure everything else counts. This was the Shadow Man who had a relationship with Sandra Dark, who protected Sandra Dark from her brother. And when we catch up with him, it seems that he's kind of left the world behind. He has his little patch of dirt out west where he's making a new life for himself. And he gets asked by some locals to help. They're branded with the symbol of Dark. And they're basically, they've been enslaved. They've been re-enslaved by Sandria Dark. And she has, you know, human slave wranglers, for lack of a better term, forcing them to work a mine to find gold for her. For what purpose, we're not exactly sure. But that's kind of the situation. And they ask for Marius's help, and he's unwilling to help until he sees that the dark symbol is there, and perhaps this is a way to be reunited with Sandria, who he still has feelings for. So he goes to the town, and he had previously encountered these slave wranglers before when they were searching for a runaway who Marius was actually helping to hide. So he confronts them, and they're about to pull out their guns and shoot him when Sandria shows up and says, "Hello, Marius, it's been a long time." And Marius expects her to kind of reciprocate the feelings that he still has for her. But she doesn't feel that way. Instead, she points out that he's got another shadow on him, a new shadow. His name is Jack. So she's acknowledging the fact that, yes, Jack Boniface is there inside Marius, experiencing all this as well. And Sandria says that, goes on to say that she senses Baron Samedi's hand in this. She wonders what game he's playing. But Marius is like, "I don't understand. Where did you go? Why did you leave?" And Sandria is like, I had no need of you. And Marius is despondent. He's like, "What are you talking about? You know, we were in love." And she says, "I bound the Shadow Loa to you to protect, so you would protect me from Nicodemo, you know, Master Dark. But now I see that duty is going to fall to Jack at some point. So I release you from your service. I don't need you anymore." And again, Marius is despondent. He said, "Your service, is that what I was to you. All I was, a servant. You know, I loved you. You took our son's life. You turned me into a monster. You never even asked me if that's what I wanted. And Sandria, she does relent a little. She's like, there'll always be a place in my heart for you, but be at peace. And she departs, and the slave wranglers are like, well, waste of a strong back, but let's basically shoot him in the back of the head and put him in a grave, without even putting up a fight. So, well, that night he rises from the grave, and goes and shows the men that are the slave wranglers that he's not someone to be trifled with. He is still the Shadow Man, and he's now willing to fight. He's driven by hate. He's driven by revenge. He no longer wants to live in peace and in hopes of one day being reunited with Sandria. He frees those that were enslaved to work the mines. And as they thank him, he says, you know, I should be the one thanking you. My head wasn't right. I was hiding from the world, and it's time to go looking. They say, for revenge? No, for her. I was wrong to say the war wasn't over. In fact, it hasn't even started. So we don't see Jack leave Marius. So it may be the following issue that we see their relationship continue. That's yet to be seen. But I'm a little of kind of two minds about this one. Because I do like the idea of Jack hopping through time and hopping from different version of Shadow Man to different version of Shadow Man and learning from them and seeing how they were able to control it, to maybe help him become a better Shadow Man and a more compelling character, in as much as he's not constantly battling against himself, because that's kind of gotten old for me at this point. But I was hoping to see a little more kind of one-offs, right? Like, we got to see the 1940s Shadow Man, and that was something we hadn't seen before. But right away in the second issue of this kind of arc, we're jumping from Shadow Man to Shadow Man. We already see him in a Shadow Man we've seen before, Marius. I kind of wish we'd jumped around to some others that we hadn't seen before first, before we went and tied it into the past. Although I enjoy that. I enjoy that it's tied into the past, the previous series of Shadow Man with Sandria and Marius. So that it is Diggle making us feel like what we read before counts. So I do enjoy that. So I guess it's kind of a wait and see at this point. I didn't enjoy it as much as issue 4 because it was so new. But I do love the fact that Diggle's bringing in old threads and old, the other story that was already laid out. He's kind of picking up the pieces from the previous iterations and building upon those rather than starting whole cloth, which, as I said, I really enjoy. He's not, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. So I really enjoyed it. Curious to know what you all think. So you can always send me an email or shoot me a message on the Valiant Fans forums and let me know what you think. So thanks for listening, everybody. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform or app you use to listen. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, as I mentioned, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. Next convention I'm going to be at is the Comic-Con Palm Springs. I think it's August. Let me take a quick look here. August 24th, 25th, and 26th. So that last weekend of August. I don't know that I'll be there all 3 days. I may just be there Saturday. But if you're going to be there, please let me know. I'd love to meet up with listeners and hook you up with a free Comic Source lanyard and take a picture and all that. So as I said, if you're going to be there, please let me know. So as always, thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll talk to you next time.